So you've heard from Andrew that you have his permission as chairman of the investment committee to ask all the speakers for today the toughest questions you can think of. And the one man who I know can handle your questions, and in fact, he's no stranger to the actual, let's call it the economic ecosystem, so to speak. And that person is Kevin Links. For those of you who may have not heard about him, he is, of course, the chief economist at StanLib, and he joined Liberty Asset Management, which, of course, later became StanLib, as an economic analyst in 2001. Prior to that, he was with J.P. Morgan Chase. There, he was a member of the macroeconomic research team. And the one thing I'm going to say, and I think this is for all the speakers throughout the day, you do have a time that is allocated, and that's the one thing about that you're going to love about me. I'm going to make sure that we get to each item on the program on time and we get to lunch on time. But the other thing is, if you see me in your periphery getting closer and closer to the stage, that generally means that time is almost up. So please be cognizant of the time. But without much further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Kevin Links.
All right. Morning, everyone. I think that time thing was aimed at me. I don't know. I just have that feeling for some reason. All right. Something wrong with the front row, obviously. That's where all the prizes are, aren't they? I think the prizes are hidden in the front row seats. So what we're going to do, there's a lot happening out there. Flip and hell, there's a lot happening out there. So we're going to focus on, the idea with this thing is to focus on South Africa because there's some positive developments, and I'm the most optimistic I've been on South Africa for a long time. So I want to chat about South Africa a bit. Normally we don't, because we find other things to talk about, because some other stuff seems more optimistic. So we need to spend a big chunk of time on South Africa, but I don't know if you've seen recent market developments have been kind of a little bit all over the place. So I need to put that in context and show you what the concern is. So we're going to talk a little bit about the US, but the intention is not to make this a US discussion. Yeah. If you want a copy of the charts, we can email it to you. Hey, don't stress. I see people have got pens. I wouldn't write down anything. I mean, you're not really here to work. I would just relax. I'd keep your phone close, because as we go through the charts, things get boring, and then when they get boring, just go to your phone. It's fine. Just fine. Engage with your phone, and then when you feel like, come back. There's no problem, right? And glance up. You know what's quite good? If you develop a rhythm, phone, screen, you develop that pattern. So you look at the screen every sort of third chart, and you'll get a sense of where we're going. Okay. So don't stress about your phone. Don't stress about writing anything. I would just sit and listen. And if it's interesting, that's a bonus. All right. So the world has been battling this inflation story. Jeez, this is a boring story, but it's been an important story. So the world had this surge in inflation. You should be aware of it. Inflation went up dramatically everywhere. Nobody escaped this other than China. And it went up to 9%, which is high by global standards, right? And there are many reasons for this. Part of it had to do with just simply supply disruptions associated with COVID. So I don't want to go through a discussion of what the hell caused this. What you can see is that there's been progress made, right? Inflation has come down, but it's not back down to the level that it was at previously. And most countries around the world feel that they've got more work to do. Whether you're looking at the US, whether you're looking at South Africa, most countries will feel we're not quite back at our inflation target. We've made good progress, but we need to continue the fight. Of course, in the last little while, there's been additional disruptions, right? The Middle East has disrupted traffic through the Red Sea. That's added to some anxiety. And there's always sort of an underlying unease about some price pressure. It could be the oil price. It could be a climate change impact on agriculture, etc. So you can't really get comfortable with where inflation is, that it's going to be under control, but you would argue that it's made good progress. And as a consequence, many countries are cutting interest rates. I know the U.S. hasn't started yet, and I know that we focus a lot on the U.S. and when the hell is the U.S. going to cut rates. But so far in the last year, 38 countries have cut rates. We monitor 80 central banks, and out of those 80 central banks, 38 have started to cut rates, and some of them have cut rates like a lot. If you go to Chile, Chile's cut interest rates in the last year, I think it's eight separate times. If you go to Hungary, if you go to the Czech Republic, there are a whole range of countries that have been cutting rates systematically over the last year. And it feels, because the U.S. hasn't started, it feels like, oh no, we haven't really cut rates globally. That's not true. Many countries have cut. Obviously, South Africa hasn't cut. And we've been conservative on purpose, and part of that conservatism from our Reserve Bank is to try and get inflation down to 4.5%. So they don't want to settle on the 3-6 and have inflation at the top end of the target. They want 4.5%. So they are being conservative, and we know they were worried about the election, and they didn't want to cut interest rates before the election in case the election went bad, and then we would have found ourselves in a lot of pressure. So we're in this global interest rate cutting cycle, right? And it's very clear that the U.S. will start in September. Their next meeting is in September. They'll start cutting. There's a debate about how much, 25, 50 basis points. There's also no doubt that South Africa will start in September. And so you're going to, during the remainder of this year, continue to see more rate cuts. And then next year, that's going to be the key theme everywhere in the world. People will be cutting interest rates. Okay, so that sounds, and that's kind of accepted now, I think. And when you look at the U.S.'s inflation, they've also made progress, but they're not back to where they were. Inflation target is 2%. They've got inflation at 3%. And it's going to take them a while to get it from 3% to 2%, but they're going to start to cut interest rates anyway. Right. So I'm hoping all of that is already understood. So what has changed? What has changed for the U.S. is that the U.S., when it comes to the Federal Reserve, they have a dual mandate, right? Their objective is not just inflation. Their objective is keep inflation under control, but also make sure that the labor market is strong. That's essentially, so they've got two jobs. They haven't got one job, two jobs. And the labor market has been strong, so they haven't been worrying about it, and they've been systematically trying to get inflation down. And then suddenly that all changed. And what changed about it? The labor market now feels weak. So now you're in a different environment for the U.S. And that different environment says, okay, we've made good progress on inflation, but now we're going to start to worry about the labor market. And because we're worrying about the labor market, we can start to cut interest rates, perhaps more aggressively, even though inflation's under control. So you're going to see, and you have seen the Federal Reserve highlight now, the fact that the employment market has gone weak. The problem for financial markets with that change is financial markets were not priced for weakness in the labor market. U.S. financial markets were priced for Goldilocks. Goldilocks being that everything continues on at a decent pace. Not too hot, not too cold. The economy grows at a decent pace. They add 200,000 jobs every month. And you have this gradual slowdown in the U.S. economy, but you get inflation under control, and there's no real disturbance. So financial markets were priced for perfection. And then on Friday, they got a shock. And on Friday, the data said, hold on, this is not perfection. This is now a lot weaker. The labor market is a lot weaker. And now there's a real risk that the U.S. will go into recession. And that changes the game, because if you're going into a recession, your market is too expensive. That earnings aren't going to hold up. Valuations are too demanding. And so the market adjusts. And it adjusted violently, and we're in that process. And so is there a chance the U.S. goes into recession? Yes. And does that mean that the market is mispriced? Yes. And if the US has a recession, does it mean the market is probably going to go softer from here? Yes. And so that's now the focus. And the US hasn't even started to cut interest rates, and the labor market has gone weaker. And so now there's this, the US must cut rates. They've waited too long. They were focused on inflation, getting inflation under control. They assumed that the labor market would continue to remain strong. And they made the wrong assumption. They made a mistake. And now the labor market has gone weaker, and now they're going to have to play catch-up. The problem with playing catch-up is once you start to cut interest rates, it takes time. Interest rates don't work immediately, instantly. So even if you start to cut now, the benefit only materializes over the next few months, the next year. And so it's like driving a ship. You've got to anticipate ahead of time. If you want to turn a big ship, you've got to start turning the wheel way before you get to the corner. I'm not saying there's corners in the sea, but you get the idea. And so that is the trick. That's the difficulty with monetary policy. You've got to turn the corner when it doesn't look like the corner's anywhere near in sight. That's your skill. That's why you are in those positions. And the Federal Reserve hasn't been able to demonstrate that skill in recent years. So how weak has the labor market got? This is how many jobs they've been adding every single month. And what you can see is that systematically they're adding less jobs. Now, is it a catastrophe? No. Last month they added 114,000 jobs. We would take that gladly, right? But 114,000 when you've been averaging 200,000 a month, that's a bit disappointing. And then when you delve into the detail, there are many sectors in the US that are now shedding jobs. And so it does feel systematically that you are adding less jobs. And it does feel like there's an established trend, and the trend is to ever lower jobs being added. On top of that, you've now got an unemployment rate that has turned the corner and is starting to move higher. And please focus on the gray bars, right? Those are the previous recessions. And have a look at when unemployment starts to rise. Does it ever start to rise and then just stop? Like it goes up a bit and then it's like, oh no, that's it. We're done. It's good now. No. If you look at when the unemployment rate starts to rise, it tends to continue on. And by definition, as it continues on, you're in a recession. So if I asked you to forecast that rise right at the end, can you see it's only a little bit? The unemployment rate's 4.3%. Where would you forecast that going? Would you forecast or anticipate that stopping at this level? 4.3%, it stops, that's it. Then you don't have a recession. But in all likelihood, given that you haven't even started to cut interest rates yet, in all likelihood, that number, that red line, is now going to go higher. And as it goes higher, you're going to have to eventually put in the gray bar for the next recession. Doesn't mean it's a severe recession. It just means that it's not as good as it has been. And given that the U.S. has gone through this phenomenal growth phase and the base is incredibly high, there's a real risk that you have a recession and that U.S. earnings are too demanding. The expectation on earnings are too demanding. Valuations are too expensive. The U.S. equity market has to adjust to an economic reality. It can adjust violently or it can adjust gradually. You would hope gradually, which means it goes nowhere for a while and it allows earnings to catch up, if you like. Or it can adjust the way it did on Friday, where it adjusts violently. Markets tend to overreact. On top of that, you do get a data point which is quite important, we think, and that is a survey of companies, and it asks them, do you intend to hire more people? So it's a survey. It's not actual data. It's just a survey. What is your intention to hire? And that's what the intention to hire looks like in the red line. And you can put it up against actual employment. And given where that intention to hire is, and we move it forward 4 months, the idea being that if your intention to hire is subdued, over the next 4 months, you're not unlikely to hire dramatically. You're probably going to hire fewer people, which means that the forward-looking indicators tell you the labor market is likely to continue to soften. And the Fed has not yet started to cut interest rates. So just be aware of that. The market is adjusting to a reality is the U.S. is likely to have a recession. Okay. Happy with that. Can we move over from the U.S.? There's a lot going on in the U.S., but we talk about it so much it's like a bit tedious. So let's talk about South Africa. How are we doing? So the way I describe South Africa is we're a big ship on the ocean going nowhere. Like a decent-sized ship. We're not a monster ship, right? We're a decent-sized ship. We're on the ocean, and we're just drifting. We're going nowhere. The good news, we're going nowhere slowly, which is way better than going nowhere fast. Okay. There are people on the ship who are in charge. They're just not in the control room. And we're trying to get them into the control room, and we need them to find the accelerator. Now, I don't know what an accelerator on a ship is called. I'm sure there's a fancy term for the thing that makes the ship go faster. Okay? But that's what you need. You need the people in charge to pitch up in the control room. They've got lights because we can hear the generator. So they've got lights. They pitch up in the control room. They find the accelerator and they like push it forward. And then they try and steer somewhere. That's what we wait in for. And we need to work out, is that happening? And we believe, bizarrely, that's starting to happen. But we've got to go through like 20 charts before I can convince you that that's happening. And along the way, you're going to get depressed. Okay. So this is manufacturing and mining activity. And can you see over the last 20 years, that is the volume of activity. Those two industries have gone nowhere. They've gone absolutely nowhere, and why is that a problem? That's a problem because the population in South Africa grows at over 1% a year. And if your population keeps growing at 1% a year, that means you keep generating people that are looking for employment. The average age of people in South Africa is something like 25 years. There's a lot of young people. And if this just continues to drift, how do you absorb the population into your economy? And the answer is you don't. So this is not a recipe for success in a country where you've got a population growth and therefore not sustainable. Okay. And there are lots of linkages. You can imagine how much manufacturing links to other industries, mining, how it links to other industries. This is dreadful. But there are a couple of industries where we do better. What do we do better at? What are we kind of known for? What we're known for is shopping. So we know how to shop, and we basically shop okay, right? And that's been some of the growth we've had. We don't save any money. We basically earn money, and we go shopping, and we've got great shopping centers. And if I put finance on that screen, let's say I took all the actuaries, and then I added a few banks, and I took some other like asset management companies, or put the whole finance thing together, where would that be on this chart? It would be kind of around shopping. So there's two things we do in this country. We bank and shop. Can you be economically successful by banking and shopping? No, not in South Africa. You just won't generate the type of employment growth you need. Why won't you? Because when we go shopping, what do we buy? We tend to buy imported goods. And the extent to which we buy imported goods is going up and up every single year. We're not making the stuff we buy. So when we go shopping, China gets thrilled, the shopping center's happy, but nobody else really benefits. And so we can't shop our way to success. Okay, now there's an added problem. Have a look at shopping. And I've given you a long-term trend. It looks okay over the long term. But if you look more carefully at the shorter term, shopping is also struggling. So let's focus in on the last 5 years of shopping. Let's see how well we've shopped over the last 5 years. And can I just say before I show you the chart, you are not far away from Sandton City. Can I please urge you, when you leave here, go shopping. We need more shop. And buy the big ticket items. None of this small stuff, eh? So let's focus 5 years of shopping. That's what we've done over the last 5 years, adjusted for inflation. So have we shopped well over the last 5 years? No, that also has been disappointing. So why haven't we shopped well over the last 5 years? Because we haven't had any money. It turns out to go shopping, you need money. We don't have money. Our income is under pressure. Why? Because our salary doesn't keep pace with inflation. On top of that, the government keeps not adjusting for fiscal drag in the tax bracket, so the government wants more money. We don't earn enough money, and so our income is under pressure. And so if you look at disposable income now in South Africa, it is actually declining. Every quarter, we are worse off. So if you feel you're worse off, it's not an aberration, you are worse off. Okay. Because our salaries are not keeping pace. And when you don't have money and you want to shop, what can you do? What is your alternative? You say, I want to shop, but I don't have the money. Are there things you can do? Yes, what could you do? What you can do is you can go get some credit. But the banks have said, no, we're not keen on credit. So the banks have tightened up. And credit growth to the household sector is now growing at 3%. 3% is below inflation of 5%. There's no real growth in credit because the banks are worried, understandably. They don't want to hand out credit. And look at personal loans. Growth in personal loans in South Africa, it is zero. Banks have tightened up. So is it every bank? No, the major banks. So how much, let me give you a number. How much is Standard Bank growing their credit card business? Credit cards to households, year-on-year growth, 1.5%. 1.5%, that's hardly any growth. How do you go shopping with 1.5% growth? What's Capitec growing their credit card business? Any idea? Capitec? 24%. So if you're thinking, I want a credit card, these guys at Standard Bank won't help me. Capitec. And I think what you need to do, don't go into the branch. Just stand outside. They'll come to you. They'll sign you up. Can I give you a credit card? Yes, thank you. So there are some banks trying to gain market share, but the total for the industry, banks are not granting credit. So essentially, the consumers run out of money, which means what? We can't grow this economy using the consumer. It's not possible. Okay, and remember, what we're looking for is better growth, better uplift, job creation. And we need to get an answer to that before we leave. And I can tell you the answer to that is not consumer spending. The consumer doesn't have any money. They want the stuff. They want it. And we're going to help them, right? We're going to give them some two-pot stuff. And we're going to give them a bit of a sugar rush. Have you given people a sugar rush? Run around buying Black Friday specials. In a country now, this is what I find bizarre, right? And you guys will understand this way more than me. This year, first quarter, we got the savings rate for South Africa, right? They released the savings rate, and I love it because they release it in savings month. And our savings rate, 12.7% of GDP, the lowest ever recorded in South Africa. The lowest ever. And when you put it up against a chart of savings rates around the world, it's like, oh my goodness, I need to find a country worse than us because I'm feeling bad. We've got one of the lowest savings rates in the world. And now in September, we're going to say, no, don't worry. Go have a little bit of fun with a third of your money or whatever it is. Crazy idea. Okay, so the consumer doesn't have money and we can't drive this economy using the consumer. So what do? We tend to, in this country, we say the government must help. The government must grow this economy. The government. What is the problem with that argument? The problem with that argument, the government also doesn't have any money. They've worked that out. So you have to give government credit for that. They finally worked it out. They've got no money. This is government debt. Now, in 2009, what was our government debt as a share of GDP? 23%. 23%. Trevor Manuel, Minister of Finance, they kicked him out. And we were an A-rated country. A-rated. Moody's gave us an A rating. Ma'am, are you worried about time? Okay, just checking because I'm nervous. Okay. Just stay where you are. 23% government debt, 2009, and A-rated. At that point, we could spend money on anything. Find me a country that has government debt of 23% today. Go find me a country. You're going to struggle. At that point, government could spend money on anything. They just had to decide what. All right? Other than stadiums, anything. And so the government spent the money. And so debt went up. Now, let me give you an idea of what the money spent was, right? Think what government's doing here. They're spending all of our tax money. They get the tax money, blow it every year. And on top of that, they take in an additional, how much? 5 trillion rand of debt. 5 trillion the debt goes up, eh? That's incredible. What did we do with that money? The government spent all of our tax money plus an additional 5 trillion rand on what? So what's government debt now today? 75% of GDP. And the problem with this government debt is not the total debt. It's how much the debt costs you. The interest cost. What is the interest cost of debt? 1 billion rand a day. Every day, Saturday and Sunday included. What could you do with 1 billion rand if you wanted to make South Africa better? Think about it. Every day, 1 billion rand. So if you say to government, grow your debt, what's going to happen? The credit rating is going to go down even further. The cost of debt will go up even more. That 1 billion rand a day will increase and overwhelm the budget. So government now, if you listen to the Minister of Finance, he has to talk fiscal discipline. He's got to talk primary budget surplus. He's got to manage the salary cost. He's got to manage expenses. He cannot grow the economy. He's got no money. He blew it. The government of South Africa blew it. And the way I see it, right? 2009, imagine you win the lotto. But not like the little lotto, like the big one, the mega prize, the mega prize. That's 2009. You came and give South Africa the lotto win. Trevor Manuel gave South Africa a lottery win, unprecedented. Government debt, 23% of GDP. That is a phenomenally powerful position. All you have to do from there is decide what to spend the money on and do it wisely. And you took that lotto and you blew it over the next 15 years. You blew it spectacularly. Are you going to win the lotto again? No. It's a one chance. Government doesn't have any money. But we still want to answer our question before I get kicked off the stage. How do we grow the economy? And in order to grow the economy, you need somebody who's got money. The consumer doesn't have any money. Government doesn't have the money. Who the hell has some money? Somebody better have some money. Otherwise, this presentation will feel terrible. Who's got the money? Turns out, corporates have got the money. So corporates are sitting with 1.2 trillion in the bank, cash. Cash on hand, cash in the bank. How much money are they, how much interest are they earning on this money? Almost nothing. And when we go, we are in asset management, right? All we do is manage money, and we want to manage that money. That money's sitting in a bank, earning nothing. And we go talk to those guys, their financial officers, and we say, give us that money to manage. We'll manage it better for you than the bank. And the chief financial officer says, no. And you say, why? Just in case. Just in case what? Now, remember when COVID hit us and people rushed out and bought toilet paper? Why did we buy toilet paper when COVID hit? I don't know, but I think if you ask people, just in case. We're hoarding cash. Now, how fast is this cash? Because inflation goes up, so your cash must go up. How fast is corporate cash growing? Let's look over the last 5 years. Terrible 5 years. How fast is corporate cash going? Corporate cash has grown twice as fast as inflation over those 5 years. How the hell do you do that? Think about the last 5 years. COVID, electricity outages, civil unrest, low growth. You name the problem, we've had it. This should have been a very difficult time for South African business. Business should be failing. Yet corporates have been able to grow their cash in the bank twice as fast as inflation. How do you do that? You have to employ a chartered accountant. And when you employ the chartered accountant and you say, I've got to fly to Cape Town to do a talk, he says, what's wrong with online webinar? You say to the chartered accountant, I need a new computer. He says, how old's your computer? He says, it's 8 years. He said, that thing can last 12 years. So the accountant is running this thing, and what is he doing? He's cutting costs. And he's loving it. Imagine this guy. I have in my mind this image, right? This guy. He goes home after the day, tough day at the office, and he sees his wifey. And he says to his wifey, oh, I'm so happy, wifey. And the wifey says, why are you such a good day? I put more money in the bank. Look at how much money I've got in the bank. He's thrilled. He's the chartered accountant. But what's the problem with that? He's not employing people. He's not investing. He's not expanding. He's not innovating. He's not doing research and development. He's not growing. He's got the money, but he's holding on to it just in case. So how much debt does this guy have? How much debt do corporates have? If you look at corporate debt relative to emerging markets, one of the lowest in the world. Now, our corporate debt, this number I'm showing you for South Africa, includes Eskom, includes Transnet, includes Denel, the post office. Why? The data is done internationally, and those entities are corporates. They happen to be government corporates. So their data gets included. You take away Eskom debt, Transnet debt, South African corporates have very little debt. So what does that tell us? Fundamentally, they have a balance sheet. They're very conservative, but they've got a good balance sheet. Not a spectacular balance sheet, but they've got a good balance sheet. And they've got the only balance sheet in the country. The government's balance sheet is wrecked. The household balance sheet, wrecked. The only balance sheet you've got in this country is the corporate balance sheet. So why don't they invest? Because they're clinically depressed. Their confidence has been below 50 since Zuma took over. And in 2004, confidence was the highest ever recorded. This data goes back to 1960. Business confidence was the best it's ever been in this country, 2004. Companies were investing, employing. Then you get the financial crisis, then Zuma takes over, and we've never recovered. I've never seen a country anywhere in the world where confidence is this low and business invests. Doesn't work like that. In order for business to take their money out the bank, they need to be confident about the future. So how do you get economic success in South Africa? You've got to make this guy happy. That's it. It's as simple as that. Make this guy so damn happy. He takes the money out the bank. He takes a bit of debt and he builds a factory. He builds something. You employ people. Those people that are employed have more money. They go shopping. They pay more taxes. Government has more money to squander. Everybody's happy. But you've got to start somewhere. What is the start? You need this guy to be happy. But why is this guy unhappy? Why is he depressed? Please don't say potholes. Why is this guy depressed? Lots of things, electricity, ports, rail, corruption. Our corruption score, we're 83 in the world. Now, when you see the high number, don't think, ooh, that sounds good, 83%. No, the higher the worse. This is the worst corruption score we've ever had. What does 83 mean? 83 means there are 82 countries less corrupt than South Africa. 82 less corrupt. So some people say to me, but then on that basis, we should be like 120. What you don't understand is competitive out there. You don't become the most corrupt country easily. You've got to work at that stuff, right? So we're learning. We're finding our way. But when you're this corrupt, you destroy confidence. And the myriad of other things, electricity, water, all of that stuff, right? Not a great environment. So who's not investing in South Africa? Who's lacking investment? The whole damn lot. Look at investment. Starting 2009, it's 5 years ago. Look at private sector investment, government investment, investment by public corporations. Nobody's investing. Now, 2019 is the reference year. How would I describe investment in 2019? My word would be pathetic. The level of investment in South Africa in 2019 was pathetic. It was hopeless. It was hugely inadequate. And look at what it's done since then. You cannot be an economic success without investment. You've got to find somebody who's got confidence and money to invest. And I can assure you, it's not government and it's not households. Okay, so at this point, you should be depressed. If you're not depressed, you do not understand the information. So why am I so optimistic? At the beginning, I said I'm the most optimistic I've been in decades. Because you never let a good crisis go to waste. And what was the crisis that changed things? Electricity. And why did electricity change things? Because it got so bad that government was forced to change their thought, to change their idea. And what did they do? You got to stage six, stage eight, and government realized, oh my goodness, we've got to do something. And what did they decide to do? They deregulated the energy sector. They said, private business, you can invest in any energy project you want. No limits. No limit on size. Just register with NERSA. You invest in that project. No restrictions. Did the government want to do that? No. So why did they do it? No choice. You were forced to do it because you had a crisis. And what did the private sector do in response to that? When you told the private sector they could invest, what did they do? They invested. So the deregulation happened in 2022. And by the time 23 rolls on, private sector, this excludes, this. None of this links to the grid. So this isn't the big wind farms and the big solar plants. This is private business. This isn't households. Private business saying, I've invested in 4,400 megawatts. And every month, this is the first 7 months of this year, every month more projects being added. What is that? Private business saying, I'm going to take care of myself. I've got a balance sheet, I'm going to take care of myself. All right. And that's helping us, absolutely. But what did it do more importantly? A light bulb went off. And government looked at this and said, oh, I quite like that. I like this. What should we do? Well, let's maybe do more of this. What is this? Private-public partnerships. And so government has now finally embraced private-public partnerships. Now, have I got evidence of that? Two proof statements I urge you to follow. First, Pier 2 Harbor. Do you know Pier 2 Harbor, Durban? Do you know Durban? So in Durban, there's a harbor. Within the harbor, there's a place called Pier 2. Pier 2 is the biggest container port in South Africa, right? Now, people say Durban's the worst harbor in the world. You must stop that nonsense. It is the sixth worst harbor in the world. Okay. So government realizes I've got a crisis at my harbor. I've got congestion. I can't get the ships offloaded. And so what did they decide to do? They decided we need private sector to run the harbor. And they put out to contract and they awarded the tender to who? A company based in the Philippines, based in Manila. And what does that company do? The only thing that company does is they run harbors. They run 34 harbors around the world, all of them better than Durban. And so the government has said to the Philippines company, you come into South Africa, you run the harbor. We will contract with you, 25-year contract. On top of that, we're going to give you an option to extend that contract for 5 years. In return, you have to bring your money into South Africa to renew the harbor, to upgrade the harbor. And the Philippines company said, I'm in. Why did the government do that? Because they're now embracing private sector participation, private sector partnership with government. Government has then said, okay, we're going to roll that out to other ports. They've already allocated Richards Bay Container Terminal, small terminal, to Grindrod. Private sector South African business is going to run that. And you've seen more evidence of that where government is saying, certainly in the port side, we want these guys to operate. Is the Philippines company going to own Pier 2? No. Government owns Pier 2. There's no relinquishing of ownership. All that happens is the Philippines company runs Pier 2 for 25 years. Second proof statement. They appoint Michelle Phillips to run Transnet. She's the first non-political appointment of a CEO. And they release their network statement. Transnet released their network statement. What is a network statement? It is an invitation to do business. An invitation to the private sector to do business with Transnet. And what is that business? Private sector will run the major rail corridors in South Africa. The manganese railway line, the coal railway line, the iron ore railway line. All of those, the intention is to get private sector contractors to run those railway lines for a long time period. Will the private sector own those railway lines? No, they'll just operate them. Is the private sector interested? Hell yes. They've already put private security. The Transnet has allowed private security onto the railway lines. The railway lines are already operating better. The intention is to partner between Transnet and the private business. And if you do that in enough areas, you change the outlook for South Africa. So there's a guy called Rudy Dix. If you get a chance, please, I would urge you go listen to him. Rudy Dix sits in the office of the presidency. And his job is he's the head of this project management team. He reports directly to the president. If he's unhappy, I'm not exaggerating, if he's unhappy with a minister not doing what he wants, he phones the president. I've been with him where he has literally done that, and the president takes his call. His job is to get this reform process going. He's in phase two. He's had significant success. That success has been endorsed. And the reason why we're more optimistic is because the coalition in the election is endorsing this. Had the coalition following the election been EFF MK with ANC, what would have happened to this reform process? It would have died. And that was the nervousness. The nervousness before the election was a realization the ANC is going to get below 50%. Who are they going to buddy up with? And if they buddied up with the EFF, you undermine the private-public partnership initiative. Why? Because that's what the EFF and the MK said directly. Because you've partnered with DA and other parties, now this initiative is alive and well. And therefore, South Africa's most optimistic policy to get our country growing. Please watch this. We'll keep updating as developments roll out. There's a lot on their agenda, and I've got a high level of confidence I'll make progress. Last thing I want to tell you, because I'm nervous about time and I'm getting to, okay. Last thing. Yes, sir. You can.
When I was listening to Rudy just speak about it yesterday, and it does seem like the one area where he has quite a bit of measured optimism, but it's very measured. I imagine some of that is how this partnership will interact with the commodity cycle.
Yes.
How do you see that? Obviously, I'm not saying let's call commodities, but is that not a huge risk factor?
Sure. So remember, we've missed out already on a commodity cycle, right? So the mining company a couple of years ago were generating super profits and paying a lot of tax money. But if you look at the volume of exports that we were generating at the time, it wasn't impressive, right? And I showed you mining production in South Africa. It hasn't accelerated. So the opportunity cost of having a congested port rail system, it's hurt us. So what you've got to do is you've got to say to yourself, I've got to develop these corridors. I've got to develop the port capacity for the longer term. I can't sit here and say, I'm going to try time a commodity cycle. You recognize that South Africa is going to remain a commodity exporter for the foreseeable future. It's a vital source of revenue. So let's upgrade those capacities so that as and when we go through different cycles, we at least, and remember, you're looking at 10, 15, 20-year contracts. It's a long-term initiative. And it's going to take a long time for this stuff to materialize. So when we're talking about these reforms, this was quite quick, right? Because you're putting solar panels on a car park. But the other stuff is going to take years. So when we look at it, we're saying in 5 years' time, South Africa's growth could be 4%. 5 years' time. Right now, we're growing at 1% last year, 0.7%. That's not good enough. You won't create jobs. But if you upgrade all of this different infrastructure or you make progress on a five-year basis, you can get 4% growth. And then it doesn't. Then whatever the cycle is the cycle. You can't invest for a cycle. You have to invest for the longer term. And Rudy Dix has lots of challenges, right? He's focusing on local government. You can imagine the challenge. So he recognizes the challenges, and they've been frustrated, but they've got good support, they've got some proof indications, and I can assure you it's the only option South Africa has right now to lift our growth rate over the next few years. Okay, that was his fault, ma'am. Please don't count that. Okay. So last thing I want to show you is, because I'm in the markets, so we worry about this, what could happen in the markets. I want to show you what foreigners have been thinking about South Africa, and you tell me if there's an upside possibility. Right. So, let's look at foreigners buying South African equities, and we're going to look at it in three phases. And foreigners have called South Africa exactly right. We haven't. We've been the asset management industry. But foreigners have read us well. So this is foreign buying of South African equities, cumulative. Starts in 94 for obvious reasons. And the scale is billions of dollars. So what are foreigners doing? 94, 95, not much. Not much buying. 96 rolls along, we release the gear document. The gear document, a business-friendly policy document from the ANC. Foreigners like it, they start to buy in. And as time rolls on, foreigners become encouraged. They see Trevor Manuel doing a good job. They see the credit rating upgrades. They see growth improving. They see South Africa becoming an A-rated country. They see government debt moving down to 23%. There were a lot of positives. And over that time, foreigners end up buying $70 billion of South African equities. That's a long time ago. So imagine what that is in today's money, right? $70 billion. Look at the global financial market crisis. Foreigners sell and then they come back. 2 minutes. He says, I'm under pressure. So foreigners sell during the global financial crisis and then they buy back to an all-time high. The financial crisis did not derail foreigners in a meaningful way. Okay. Then what changes in 2010, 2011? Can you think of anything that changes around then? Do you think maybe a leadership change, something like that? So the ANC puts Zuma in charge and foreigners say, ooh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about this guy. This guy's been facing rape trial. He got off, but I don't know about this guy. But I like South Africa. I've put a lot of money into South Africa. So what do I do? What do you think foreigners did for the next 4 years with their money? They worried, but they like us. What did they do? They went sideways. Phase two, they just held their position. Not a bad strategy. It's saying, well, let's wait and see. Let's see if Zuma's good for this country. We believe in this country. We think they're doing good things. But we don't want to put more money in because we're not sure about this Zuma guy. They do that for 4 years. How much did the equity return in that time? What was that equity return over that time? An average of 14% a year. And fund managers are packing themselves on the back thinking they did that, right? And they're getting big bonuses and they're running around telling everybody that they're great asset managers. Foreigners bought $70 billion of South African equities and the JSE gave you a 14% return a year. You could buy any equity. they all went up. In the next phase, the return is more like 10%. It's still a decent return, but it's not as spectacular. And then in 2016, what happens? Any idea? What happens? What happens? The foreigners realize, no, this guy's bad. South Africans are saying things like, no, but he's quite charming. And foreigners realize, this guy's bad. And what do foreigners do over the next few years? Let's bring it right up to date. Phase three. Foreigners sell out. And our return from the JSE is less than inflation over that time every year. And fund managers are struggling, and now they sell you an income fund. Not so. They don't sell you an equity fund because that thing's not generating. All of those promises of inflation plus 6 and 7, that's gone now. Tough market. The key question is, let's assume that Rudy Dix does a decent job over the next 5 years. Let's give him some leeway. Let's assume that we get the Transnet stuff developed, we get some rail corridors, we ease the electricity thing on a more sustainable basis. Let's make that assumption. At some point, what is this guy going to do? At the moment, he's selling every single month. What does he start to do? He says, okay, I'll go sideways. I've sold, but South Africa's cheap. I'm just going to go sideways. And then if we manage to pull off this turnaround, at some point he comes back. And when he comes back, he's coming back from a very low position, and fund managers are patting themselves on the back again. So this is critical for the industry we're in, the investment industry. If this guy does not come back, wow, it's going to continue to be tough going. There's going to be more consolidation, more fallout, because what are you doing? You're relying on South Africa's low savings rate to grow your industry. It won't work. You need somebody else's savings. We call that investment. That is it. So there are many consequences of this reform process. If it works, if Rudy Dix does his job, there's upside. If you say to me, no, it's not going to work, I can't offer you anything, then South Africa's really looking at a bleak environment where our ship just keeps drifting in the ocean. And eventually they find it marooned on an island. Thanks, guys. I've been rushed off the stage politely. Hope that makes some sense.
What I'm going to do, and just take a minute, I just want to check if there are any quick questions that we have for Kevin. We'll take that one, and then I'll let the other question count as part of the...
Yeah, meeting. I think so. And he is hogging. Can you see how he's hogging this?
Yeah, I can see that. I've got my eye on him.
Yeah, okay. Just watch him for the rest of the day.
Is it okay, sir? If I don't use this?
I think let's just use it, just in case we are recording.
Okay. So my question is just around kind of how the US Fed for so long was kind of the center of monetary policy globally. But of course, we have the transatlantic interest rate dispersion and kind of how central banks are buying gold in lieu of USD with the weaponization of the dollar. Do you think a Trump-Vance presidency will speed up this move away from the Fed as the center?
Yeah. Yeah, at the margin, it does that. So remember, what Trump is about... the U.S. is first. But what that tends to mean is the U.S. doesn't want to get involved in things they have no interest in, which means they kind of step away from being policemen of the world, and they withdraw from many of the expenses that they're currently incurring, and they focus domestically. And so by doing that, you're withdrawing from your global role. Not entirely, but you are doing that. And once you withdraw from your global role and you, the U.S., then you are effectively also withdrawing your economic role in the world. And so over time, that would work against the role of the dollar and the power of the Federal Reserve. Having said that, though, they remain incredibly... You can just see the market reaction on Friday. So they remain the center of the world. There's a lot that would have to change to derail that. But at the margin, yes, that's the direction they seem to be going.
All right, so okay. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Kevin.
Guys.
Let's give him a round of applause. He was fantastic.